I'm David W. Berner, and this is The Writer Shed. Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 15 of The Writer Shed podcast from Writer Shed Press, an indie publisher just outside Chicago with its offices. Yes, inside an 8x10 writing shed on the property of its founder, me. And today, we are actually outside the shed. It's 90 degrees, and it's been 90 degrees here for several days. The shed is not air-conditioned. There's a fan, but sometimes it's just too hot to work in there. So today, I'm outside rather than inside, just outside the shed. The outside is a good place to be for our guest this episode, too. Bill Fink is an award-winning travel writer and photographer. He spends a lot of time outside. He recently wrote a piece in Drive Magazine, a Subaru publication, by the way, that caught my eye and imagination. Three road trips to independent bookstores in the country. Bill took on California, Texas, and New England. For lovers of the written word and the open road, what could be better? Bill, thank you, first of all, for being here. Appreciate that. You're in Los Angeles, is that right?
I'm in Oakland, California.
Oakland, California. Okay, sure. Across the bay from San Francisco. I saw the work, your piece about the road trip in the indie bookstores. My wife, we're Subaru owners, so we got the magazine like everybody does. Okay. And she handed it to me. Goes, I think you'd like this. And I loved it. I really, I love the connection between the road trip and the bookstore. What made you think that would be the kind of thing that people would love? Obviously, you loved it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they always say, write about what you know about. And I definitely know haunting used bookstores since I was a kid trying to find books I could afford to buy. And I found personally that it's kind of a unique way to discover about a place when you're traveling, to go to these little shops and find some niche publications. And it's a way of, for readers to get beyond the standard tourist sites to discover kind of that local feeling about a place.
Yeah, it kind of is like a little bit of a mirror on the town that it's in, right? That the indie bookstore.
Right. It's usually people have been there, lived there a long time and usually have strong opinions about this or that, so you can have some fun conversations there too.
Right. So let's talk about the actual piece that you wrote. You took on really three road trips: California, Texas, and basically New England, right? So tell me why were those places chosen, and let's get into what you found.
Well, I live in California, so that was kind of a no-brainer to talk about a lot of these shops that I've visited on my own road trips. And magazine being a national one, wanted to cover some other areas of the country. And I had visited some of those other shops in the past as well. And it was just a matter of putting together some pieces, talking about the bookshops and, some book and non-book related things you can see on a road trip from point A to point B.
Yeah, so I saw that, particularly about that in the California piece, you talked about the Steinbeck Home and Museum, right? That was part of the travel.
Right, yeah, just off of Cannery Row in Monterey that he wrote about a lot. They have a real nice Steinbeck Museum, and you can visit some of the sites and the books if you're a Steinbeck fan, and after going to the museum, you may become one. So it's kind of a neat place to stop.
Sure. So tell me, what was it that made you link road trip with book, though? With the idea of linking the road trip with an indie bookstore trip?
Yeah, I think, any trip, especially for me as a travel writer, is talking about the journey of the trip, not necessarily the destination, and making discoveries as you go along. So it's kind of made sense to me that these bookshops are kind of part of this discovery process of driving through California or Texas or New England, that you can, like I said, find something out about these small towns as you look through their stacks in the bookstore.
So it was kind of an exploration and a discovery of, parts of America in a way,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So what did you generally find about Americans in their indie bookstores? What did you take away from those three road trips?
I think that, despite what you may read in the news, that printed books are not dying. They're they're still alive and well. People have a fascination with them. And even, you know, in the times of COVID and quarantine, people were looking to find a way to share their love for books and love for reading, and even masked up and on outdoor stacks at these shops, people are gathering and talking about books and sharing their recommendations and making their own literary or nonfiction discoveries.
What did you find particularly like the link between someone who owns an indie bookstore? What kind of people are they?
You know, there's a lot of cranky old folks in there, but that's what makes it sort of fun. They're, you know, always have opinions, usually happy to share them. You know, there's plenty of shops that don't have, you know, the most convivial owners and, you know, those ones I didn't write about. But I found that, you know, the owners generally have been in the place for a long time, know a lot about it, and have their own very particular interests that got them into bookselling. And they'll, you know, share their recommendations and whatever particular subgenre I never would have thought of reading about. So it's kind of fun that way.
What about the people that are, you know, the customers? Were they, was there a thread that goes through all of them, no matter where you were in the country?
No, I think it's a variety of young folks and old folks and everyone in between. You know, obviously people who have the time to read and enjoy books. So there's a certain amount of, you know, privilege involved in there.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, used bookshops are, you know, a lot of people are looking for deals, looking to find an obscure used book for pennies on the dollars. So you have treasure hunters in there. You have people just looking for somewhere to work on their laptop that's quiet and maybe grab a book on their project while they're there. So, you know, I think there's still a fair amount of variety of people going to the shops.
You mentioned you saw, you know, a fair amount of young people too. I guess that's a good thing for us, you know, who are all up in our years, to see that, you know, the it sounds like such an old man to say this, but the young people are reading, you know. I mean, is that true? Did you get that feeling?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think there's, you know, bookshops with children's sections, so you can see the next generation coming along, but even the, you know, millennial types and, you know, plenty of, you know, book nerd college students are going in there, and, you know, high schoolers looking for, you know, an obscure science fiction book or, you know, whatever new subgenre those kids are reading these days.
Yes.
And I think, I mean, that's what brought me into bookshops as a junior high school student is, you know, I couldn't find the science fiction books I was looking for in any library. So wanted to buy them, couldn't afford it in a new bookshop. So would go to these used bookshops. So I think you get similar younger people kind of looking for their niche publications, and then they find similarly minded people there, and you see, you know, little posters up, you know, meeting of the whatever society of Harry Potter fans or whatever it may be. So that's kind of neat to see.
What did you find? You said, you know, you had a particular bent for the idea of finding a treasure out there. Did you personally find anything? Were you looking?
Yeah, I'm always keeping my eyes open. You know, my latest thing is finding, as a travel writer, finding old obscure travel logs from, you know, 100 years ago, things people wrote in the 20s and 30s about traveling through, you know, the non-existent Yugoslavia or wherever. And those aren't real high treasure books these days. It's my own particular interest, so they're cheap to find. So I've been gobbling some of those up and finding some pretty entertaining travel logs, maybe only to me, but that's fine.
Yeah, well, that's good. And you did find some then?
Yeah, absolutely. I've discovered Harry Frank, who was kind of like the Rick Steves of the 1920s and wrote 40 or 50 books, and I had never heard of him. So I've had a fun time picking those up for, you know, $1 or $2 a piece.
Wow, that's really a good find. Were there some books that were, you know, had more treasures than others? You know what I mean by that? Like ones that had things that might be more of a treasure to most of the readers than others? Were there ones that were like that?
Yeah, definitely. The Larry McMurtry's old shop in Texas, Booked Up, is kind of famous nationally to book geeks. Larry McMurtry wrote Lonesome Dove and, right, you know, 20 other books, and had been collecting rare and antique books all his life. So he was still, you know, working in the shop in his 80s, still collecting, you know, medieval manuscripts and stuff they're selling for $20,000-$30,000 that, you know, they wouldn't let me touch while I was there, but are certainly there for the antiquarian. So it's kind of fun going to these shops and seeing these actual treasures that, you know, maybe I'll buy when I have a couple of bestsellers or something, but for the time being, just fun to look at.
Well, I know you have a, you have to have a natural affinity for California living there, but were of the three places you went, you know, New England, basically Texas, California, was one more appealing to you than another, and why so, if so?
Yeah, I mean, I, like you said, I have a bias for California living here, and it's talking, you know, visiting these shops, discovering a lot of things about my own state, and obviously they have more of a liberal, diverse bent than some of these other shops. But, you know, I think just about anybody at a bookstore is going to be, you know, fairly open-minded and stocking books. So I think you find, you know, pockets of, you know, intelligentsia or whatever in any of these places. You're going to stop, you know, going to Marcus Books, for example, here in Oakland. I had never been there before, and it's the oldest Black-owned independent shop in the United States. They had been active in the Black Power movement in the 60s and are still very active in the community, and stopped in there and talked to the owner, who's the daughter of the original owners. And she kind of pointed me the way to find some books about the racial politics and background of my own city that I didn't know about before. So that was kind of cool to make discoveries even in my own backyard.
Wow. Yeah. Open up your mind to something that was right there in front of you in a lot of ways. Right. Mm-hmm. Were there bookstores along the way too, that I guess were like that? They were linked to a particular genre. They were linked to a particular movement. I mean, you saw that obviously, right?
Yeah, definitely. I was visiting a friend in Amherst, Massachusetts, and he wanted me to include a bookstore that was run by two lesbian witches. I decided that might be a little too niche for a national publication, but yeah, you'd be surprised what you can find out there. You know, well, there's yeah, a shop for everyone.
Now we know about the one in Amherst, Massachusetts. I'm thinking back to, you know, the Scarlet Letter now when I hear you say that. So was there something that surprised you on this trip?
I think it was, you know, I thought a lot of these places would be dying out, you know, with the combined, you know, internet reading and Kindle reading and ordering from Amazon, combine that with the pandemic. But a lot of these shops were thriving and even expanding. They were buying more space and adding more books. So I really didn't anticipate that in my travels. That was heartening to see.
That's a good thing. Yeah, it sounds like one of those very romantic kind of trips that a lot of us who are, you know, bookophiles would find to be romantic. And you sound like you're that kind of person. Did you find it that way, or was it an arduous kind of approach?
You know, there's hit and misses. You know, I'd stop in, you know, shops that had overpriced books and surly owners and not very many customers. So, you know, that's part of the fun almost of discovery, is you go through a lot of lemons before you find that, you know, sweet pie of a place.
Yeah.
So certainly not every shop is a, you know, open-minded, you know, chatty bookstore with great deals. So that's why it's kind of useful to highlight some special ones here.
Right. So what's your next plan here for in your life as a travel writer?
You know, hope COVID ends so I can keep traveling, for starters.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought about that.
But yeah, I've been doing a lot of, you know, given the COVID outbreak, a lot of outdoorsy type travel, active adventure in the national parks, and working on a a piece now about the slow travel movement, how you can really see more by seeing less, so to speak, that rather than, you know, doing the typical European, you know, 8 countries in 7 days type trip, you just plop down in one place, explore the local community, you know, take a cooking class or a, you know, art class or something and really sink your roots into an area for a week or two. So that's kind of a new type of travel that I think may be coming out of this pandemic where people, you know, want to travel somewhere, but not be crazy about it. So
yeah, I really like that idea. I like, I'm not a, the kind of person who wants to get in a tour bus and, you know, wave at the sights going by. I would much rather sit in a cafe for 4 hours somewhere in a place that I've never known.
Yeah,
that's more of me. So as a travel writer, if we can talk a little bit about, you know, what you've been doing with your life, you know, I have writers all the time and I teach workshops and things. And a student may say to me, or a workshop attendee might say to me, I want to be a travel writer. In this day and age, what does that mean?
You know, I think there's a couple different sides of it. You know, one is the service angle where you're giving people specific tips and tricks. You know, how do I see Paris in, you know, $100 a day or whatever that may be? And here's the top 10 sites. And then there's kind of the literary travelogue side of things where you're talking about a voyage of discovery and it's really just writing stories that happen to be about different places or getting from one place to another.
Right.
So I think, you know, that type of writing, you know, has the same rules as writing about, you know, cooking writing or, you know, interview pieces where you just try to find an interesting story that resonates with people. And then sometimes you can combine the two sides. You do that service element that has a kind of narrative arc to it. So I try to work that into my assignments that might otherwise be boring, you know, 10 top water slides on cruise ships or something. You know, it's tough to make that exciting, but, you know, try to find a quirky angle in there.
Yeah. You know, when I think of travel writing, you know, I think of, you know, some of the greats out there that have been doing this for years. And I'm not talking about the ones that are linked to, you know, the cruise ship slides or anything like that. Sort of like getting on a train in Cairo and, you know, traveling on that train for a long time and just telling us what you see. Those are the kinds of things I love. And I think that's what the students mean when they say they want to be a travel writer. They want to be deep dive kind of person who many times writes in first person, you know.
Yeah.
So for, if you were had to choose the thing you haven't done yet as a travel writer, what would that be?
I mean, there's been plenty of places I haven't been to. I'd like to go to, you know, the whole Indian subcontinent and a lot of parts of Africa. But I think a style of writing, you know, is a personal travel log. You know, I went here and I was so, you know, heartened by seeing these refugees or whatever is almost getting cliched these days.
Yeah.
To try to, I think the next step is sort of make yourself a little more invisible in the story to talk about a place based on the people you meet there and tell the stories of those people rather than talking about, you know, isn't it cool I got to go to these exotic destinations? So
yeah, isn't the best travel writing really not about the place? It's kind of about the people. Isn't that kind of true?
Yeah. I mean, it's the, you know, everything that defines the place. It's the people, it's the physical environment, you know, type of commerce going on, or the, you know, it could be the weather patterns or anything. And it's putting all those pieces together to tell a story. You know, I think it's not just enough to say, hey, I met, you know, crazy Elmo in Siberia, and here's his story about, you know, ice swimming, you know, is not really enough. But if you can talk about, you know, crazy Elmo in the context of the history of, you know, Siberian labor camps or whatever it might be, I think that's where you have the story.
Is there a Crazy Elmo?
No, I just made that up. That's creative nonfiction.
But that'd be great if there was. One of the more popular, I guess you could call him a travel writer, that people know about is Anthony Bourdain. I mean, he obviously started out writing about food, but he became absolutely, to my mind, a travel writer. And he went into places with the most open of minds. At least that's what came across on television. And what I've read about him since, that's been written about him since his death, that seemed to be very true. That he went in with a very, very open slate and just said, I'm here. Yeah, it's hard for people to do, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. You definitely show up to a place with your own prejudices and preformed opinions. And a lot of people are just looking for data to support that, to say, whatever, the Italians are a crazy, passionate people. And I went there and I found these crazy, overpassionate people. But you could go there and find, very studious, people at a university and do a completely different study. So I think that was maybe Bourdain's specialty, is finding these people and letting them tell their own stories rather than imposing your story on them and using them as data points.
Yeah, you can see his transition into travel writing. If you watch all the shows he'd been through, you could just see the transition and the maturation, really, of a good observer. And I guess that's really what you really have to be able to do, right, as a travel writer, is be truly an incredibly good observer.
Right. And, it's also looking for the right things to observe and finding something significant about it. I think Bourdain's special, he's not talking about just cooking, he's talking about the place he's in and putting the food into that context. Somebody else saying, oh, I want to be a travel writer, I'm going to write about somebody making soup in France, and it could be the most boring thing you've ever seen. So it's that combination of kind of finding those great stories and then, putting it into a context that can appeal to people who are not into cooking or not into fishing or geology or whatever it may be, to somehow make that story more universal.
So what's next for Bill Fink? What is he doing now? Waiting for the pandemic to end, obviously, but what's on your calendar?
Yeah, I mean, it's continuing to do some travel pieces and finding engaging stories out there and working on a couple longer form pieces, to try to branch out of the standard magazine newspaper stories of, 1,500, 2,000 words, and working on a couple book ideas based on my travels of a year I lived in the Philippines, and another one as kind of satire of the travel industry, talking about, the crazy world of influencers and how everything's getting stood on its head these days with kind of the me first marketing. So sort of one more serious book, one kind of silly book, and keep those on the side as I keep trying to crank out some good travel stories.
Well, one of those good travel stories is this one, the one about the road trips to indie bookstores, California, Texas, in New England. So it was great. It was really fun to read, even though it was just like little snippets, but it really gave you a picture of what that road trip and what those people along the way were like.
Yeah, appreciate it. Glad you liked the story. It was a fun one to go out there and research. And I hope a lot of readers and listeners get out there and find either these bookshops or some good ones in their own community and help support these booksellers and maybe find a few treasures.
Yeah, and just by the way, folks, you do not have to be a Subaru owner to read this piece. You can find it on the web. Just look up Drive Magazine and do a search for Bill Fink or do a search for indie bookstores and you'll find it. So, Bill, thanks again so much. It was a pleasure.
All right, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Wonder if Bill might need a co-pilot on the next indie bookstore road trip. A note on the Writer Shed Press, Writer Shed Stories Volume 3. Our pub date is set now, October 15th. Paperback and Kindle versions will be available. 14 writers from all over the world. You can read more on the coming volume and the writers in our newsletter. Easy to sign up for that at writershedpress.com. In the coming weeks, we hope to showcase some of the writing in Volume 3 here on the podcast with some readings from our contributors, including one of our writers from a previous volume, Writing Coming to Life Through the Voice of the Writer. We always like to do that when we get a chance. This has been Episode 15 of The Writer Shed. I'm David W. Berner. Our music is from IRA Music, production and interviews produced in The Shed. You can find out more about Writer Shed Press at writershedpress.com and at Writer Shed on Medium. You can also sign up for our newsletter there and find us at Writer Shed Press on Twitter. The Writer Shed is available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.